think it was, what, a week or two ago, it was actually what we call Dharma Day. Interestingly enough, we were so absorbed in the Dharma at Padmaloka, we didn't actually mark it, we didn't notice. We were studying the Transcendental Principle, the first chapter of the survey, and Dharma Day sort of, well, it was a two-week festival for us, I suppose. That's my excuse, anyway. But the full name of Dharma Day is Dharma Chakra Pravartana Day. Dharma Chakra Pravartana Day. This is very important. The setting in motion of the wheel of the Dharma, the wheel of the truth, the wheel of the Dharma. How can you translate the word Dharma? The setting in motion of the wheel of the truth, the revolution of the wheel. And the very name of the of this festival, the very name of this first teaching of the Buddha is hugely significant, that I think is often lost sight of in the modern secular West. It's not that the Buddha gave his first sermon. I mean, that's what it can sort of seem like, and there's this detailed exposition of the Four Truths and so on. It's quite probable that he didn't actually teach the Four Noble Truths at his first communication of the Dharma. Really what is being talked about is the first time in which the Buddha, freshly, newly enlightened, communicated directly to his first disciples the way things really are. The liberating truth that he discovered beneath the Bodhi tree. And in a way, the essential message, yes, it is embodied in words, but it would have been so much more than that. And of course, you probably remember the story that he went to talk to his old friends, his old ascetic friends, who'd left him when he gave up austerities to eat solid food, because he found it, the way of austerities was not the way to liberation. They didn't want to talk to him, they didn't want to welcome him, but they gradually melted as he came into the deer park, and then they gradually opened up to him. It's probable that they had a kind of retreat together. It was the rainy season, and they would have been in retreat together with the Buddha really communicating with them, really meeting with them. And it's very interesting, when Kandanya wakes up, he's the first disciple who wakes up, it's said that what he sees is whatever has a beginning has an ending. Those things that arise with a beginning must have an ending. So the opening of the Dharma eye for Kandanya is seeing the profound truth of impermanence. Whatever is liable to arising is liable to cessation, which is actually a deeply mysterious truth when you really meditate on it. And when Kandanya saw, what happened? The gods rejoiced. All of the levels of the hierarchies of gods throughout the cosmos rejoiced at when they saw that this truth had been transmitted, that another man had become liberated, that the Dharma had been made known. And they rejoiced and they said, the wheel of the Dharma is set in motion by the Blessed One, by the Bhagwan. And there's this great sadhu shaking the entire threefold, triple thousand world system. It sounds fantastic, I know, but that's what the tradition tells us. And it's very significant that they use this term, he sets in motion the wheel of the Dharma. The wheel of the Dharma. The wheel of the Dharma is related to ancient Indian notions of kingship, of royalty. The wheel of the Dharma is based on the wheel of the what's known as the universal monarch, the Chakravarti, very important kind of mythic symbol in ancient India. The Chakravarti is the king, the just king, who creates order in the land through his rule. So what the Buddhist tradition is saying, that when the Buddha teaches the Dharma, when he communicates the Dharma, and the communication involves the other person really getting it so that they become enlightened as well. It's not just him just dishing out a teaching and leaving them to it. There's a real meeting if you like, a transcendence of self and other, somebody else becoming an arahant, when that happens, the Buddha becomes the king of the universe, the king of the spiritual universe, the king of the world of the Dharma. This is really important. That, and now there is order, there is a way to liberation. So it's very much things are being set right with the Buddha's enlightenment, with the Buddha's teaching, with the Buddha's communication. The world can be set right again, because now it has its true spiritual king. Very, very important to appreciate this point. It's making it clear as well that the Buddha isn't just another teacher, another sort of saintly man. Buddhist tradition says no, he is the embodiment of the highest possible spiritual ideal, and he's establishing the truth in the cosmos, in the universe. And it's bringing about a kind of revolution. It's interesting, this word pravartana can also mean revolution, a Dhamma revolution, as we call it in India. It's one of the reasons why Dr. Ambedkar was so taken with the Buddha, brought about the conversion movement to Buddhism in India, a social revolution, because, yes, there is the revolution of the truth. Things are being set right. And we know very well that the Buddha had this effect. His appearance on the Indian scene, and by implication the world scene, had an enormous impact, an enormous effect. I mean, primarily in terms of showing people the way to liberation. There was the atmosphere was electric, it seems, with the Buddha's first communication of the Dharma. The weeks that followed the enlightenment, so many people were responding to his presence, to his teaching, to his communication. Not just the five ascetics, but also later on the Yasha and his friends and their families. So many men going forth that the Buddha was accused of kind of destabilizing society and putting a spell on young men to woo them away from their families, that kind of thing. But it wasn't just men. Unusually, women eventually started to go forth. I think the Buddha was the first leader, really, spiritual teacher in India, who gave a viable place for women wanderers, women to go forth, as well as the first teacher, really, to provide a viable spiritual path for householders, people who didn't go forth. And crucially, a critique of caste, a very powerful critique of the social structure, of the graded order of inequality that was so pervasive, and a radical reappraisal of the whole of morality. Morality wasn't to do with caste duty and following the right rituals. Morality is to do with karma, in the sense of intentional action proceeding from skillfulness or unskillfulness. So a massive kind of revolution and realignment, if you like, the creation of a sort of mandala. I'll say a bit more about that later, because even the term mandala comes from notions of kingship in India. So a massive change by coming about through the Buddha. People finding a way. You see this in when people go for refuge to the Buddha. Typically they say things like, the Dharma has been communicated in many ways by the Blessed One. It's as if that which has been knocked over has been set up. So, you know, it was all a mess before. Now it's as it should be. It's as if a light has been lit in the darkness, so that those with eyes can actually see. It's as if a path has been shown to somebody who was lost. So this sense of order coming, a true order, a way based on the truth, something you can really rely on. And after saying those things, they would go for refuge. They would say, to the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dhamma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go, as long as breath lasts. In every breath I will go for refuge to the end of my life, throughout my life. So there's this sense of people going for refuge on that basis. Later on, as Buddhism developed in India, you also find developing, particularly in the Mahayana, the idea of, or the vision, or even the experience of the pure land, the pure Buddha field, the pure Buddha kshetra. And this is a vision of a completely transformed society, with the Buddha, a Buddha, at the centre, and the environment in this land is totally conducive to the Dharma. All you have to do is sit on your lotus, open up to the Buddha, open up to all the signs and smells and sights around you, and you'll just become liberated. This is the great vision. There are even pure lands where the Buddha, apparently in that particular pure land, just communicates through fragrance and perfume. I quite fancy that pure land myself. You sit under your fragrant tree and you're just getting these different fragrances which are somehow moving you into Buddhahood. So it'd be a very nice pure land. The Buddha, a sort of scent DJ, as it were. Sorry if I brought the tone down. Anyway, so the pure land, in a way, is an idea of a mandala. You have this central figure communicating the Dharma to a perfect land, perfectly ordered to bring about liberation. And in later Buddhist tradition, much later Buddhist tradition, the Tantric tradition, this is taken even further, where the mandala really assumes a great prominence. And in this idea is, this notion is that what a mandala is a central symbol of enlightenment, a Buddha, a Bodhisattva, a deity of some kind, living in a great palace on top of a great kind of cosmic mountain, with a whole universe around him of different figures and different symbols. You would be instructed to imagine yourself like this. And again, it's an image of the complete transformation of your entire life and world. Complete identification with enlightenment and seeing the world as a domain of enlightenment. And as I say, this image of a mandala comes from Indian notions of kingship. Indian notions of kingship. You even get this description that a great king is at the centre of a mandala. His world, his country, is a mandala in which he is supposed to bring order and stability, where everything is harmoniously arranged, you know, for the good of everybody in that realm. I mean, whether it actually worked like that and what the notions of order and so on in ancient India were about, it can be questioned. But Buddhism is taking over this idea for the spiritual development of the individual. The mandala image, the mandala symbol, literally means circle or sacred circle, is really a symbol of total transformation of oneself and all of the kind of business with which one, all the affairs of one's life. But you can extend it further. The mandala vision is the vision of the total transformation of the world itself. And Sangharakshita does pick up on this idea, trying to make it very, very practical to us. In a few places, he talks about looking at our lives as a mandala. There we are, we have this life, we have all sorts of relationships in our life, we have all sorts of affairs in our life, all sorts of, you know, work, play, rest, family responsibilities or community responsibilities, and so on and so forth. We have this whole life, and you can look at it as a mandala. And he says, when you go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, or the meaning of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, is that you're placing the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha at the centre of your life, at the centre of your mandala. And everything is being transformed in the light of what is at the centre. In the light of what is at the centre. There might even be things that have to leave your, as it were, personal mandala, because those activities are just not conducive to what you've placed at the centre. And you can sometimes feel that in going for refuge, that there's certain things that you're doing that conflicts with the act of going for refuge that conflicts with what's at the centre. And I think we have to be really honest about this. You know, you do get this sort of narrative sometimes, well, you should be able to be in touch with the refugees wherever you go. And, you know, it's all pervading. Well, if it is, groovy, fantastic, no problem. But very often it isn't. And you can't sort of pretend it is by some sort of fancy kind of idea. We have to be really honest in really looking at our lives and what we do and see how they really match up, how they line up with what is most precious to us, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and be completely honest about that fact. Sangharakshita, let me just read you the passage where he talks about this. This is in The Ten Pillars of Buddhism, which I think is one of his very best works, actually. It's very, very pithy and an absolutely essential text to read and reread and read again and again and reflect on if you've asked for ordination, if you're an order member. It's an absolutely crucial text. Some of you are staying on for the next retreat, which is on the Ten Pillars. Let me just read you what he says. One goes for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and the Sangha, or in more contemporary idiom, commits oneself to them when one decides that to attain enlightenment is the most important thing in human life. And when one acts, or does one's best to act, in accordance with that decision. This means organising one's entire life in all its different aspects in such a way as to subserve the attainment of enlightenment. It means placing the ideal of enlightenment, that is placing the Buddha, which Buddha one can oneself become, at the centre of one's personal mandala, and arranging one's different interests and activities in such a way that they are placed nearer to or further away from the centre of that mandala in accordance with the degree to which they help or hinder the attainment of enlightenment. Interests and activities which are opposed to the ideal of enlightenment should, of course, be banished from the mandala. Going for refuge is the fundamental Buddhist act. It's what makes one a Buddhist, a follower of the Dharma, or a Dharmachari, etc. So I think that puts it very, very clearly using this mandala idea. So it means placing the Buddha, the ideal of enlightenment, which we are striving for, at the centre of one's personal mandala, and arranging one's different interests and activities in such a way that they're placed nearer or further away from that ideal. And there might even be interests and activities that have to be out of the mandala, presumably unethical activities and so on, or even particular relationships. Not saying what they are or what they should be. It's a very, very interesting way of looking at things. And it's making it clear that, if you like, the mandala principle is a very dynamic one. It's describing the transformation of our entire life. If you like, it's another way of talking about the vision and transformation idea that you get in the Eightfold Path. You have a vision, and then there's transformation. But this is looking at it in a way more spatially, looking at our life now and how everything can be transformed in the light of what is at the centre. And the centre means, I think we must also add here, this isn't just a kind of organisational point. This isn't a time management issue, although time management might come into it. I've heard some people talk about this idea of organising their life with the three jewels at the centre. And it's kind of heartless. It's sort of, oh well, you know, I've got my bit of meditation then, and I take the dog for a walk, and, you know, and then there's a bit of this, and then there's a bit of that, and then there's exercise down the gym, and, you know, and it's all sort of time. And I go on retreat, and, you know, and it's all sort of, as it were, time management, as if that's enough. I'm giving a certain amount of hours to Buddhism, and a certain amount of hours, and a certain amount of hours for that. It's an organisational issue. That's not what's being got at. Placing the Buddha, Dharma and the Sangha means, at the centre, means placing it at the heart centre of our life. The heart centre. I'm also reminded of this point that in the traditional mandalas that you get, the centre isn't on a flat plane. The centre is at the top of a cosmic mountain. The deity is the monarch, is the king or queen of the mandala, if you're meditating on a feminine deity. They are the wise and glorious ruler. There's a hierarchical relationship, in other words, with the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha and all the other things that you're doing. You're placing the Buddha, Dharma and the Sangha at the centre means that they're your most cherished, revered ideals. They really are the jewels for you. They really are the most precious things in existence, to be cherished, valued, revered. And their light's going to shine on every activity, affecting every activity. This is really important, to remember, that they're elevated, in other words. So placing them at the centre is at the elevated centre, yes, the heart centre of our life, of our existence. So how do we do it? How do we actually do it? You know, how do we bring this about? I mean, this is really the exploration of the whole retreat. How do we, bring this about? Of course, well, you practice the Dharma, and it all takes care of itself. You just do as much Dharma as you can, and everything will be fine. And there's a certain truth in that. But I think we can do a bit better than that. I think we can look a bit more deeply. And I think, to begin with, I think we need to consider this word. I've already used this word, revere or reverence. I think we can begin to appreciate what it means to place the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha at the heart centre, on the heart throne, the heart mountain, if you like, of our life, by really considering this word reverence. A very, very important word in Buddhist tradition. So I want to do a little bit of reflection on reverence and see what that does really for you. It's not a word that perhaps we even particularly like using. It's perhaps a word that's sort of gone out of fashion. We think of, if we think of the Reverend so-and-so, well, the clergyman can be a sort of figure of fun, and so on in films and comedies and so on. But the word reverence we're using it as a shorthand, as a translation for the Pali word Gaurava, which is in Sanskrit Gaurava. And actually, I've realised it's a very hard word to translate. It comes from a root meaning weighty or heavy. And the whole idea is that you revere, you honour, you look up to, because you're definitely looking up to something. And there's also connotations of cherishing and a sense of this is tremendously important. Even that perhaps quality of mysterium tremendum that is talked about in mystical literature. You do that for what is greater than you, what has real weight for you, what sort of really presses upon you positively, what you're awed by, perhaps what you deeply, deeply love and, yes, revere, look up to. This is what we're trying to get at with this word, reverence, Gaurava, Gaurava. It's etymologically related, by the way, to the word guru. Guru could be translated as the heavy one, not heavy in the sense that they're going to, push you around and all that, but a teacher, a guru for you is the person who has real weight for you, real spiritual quality. They're weighty with qualities. Sometimes the Padmasambhava mantra is translated as Vajra Guru is the one, the adamantine one, weighty with qualities, full of qualities, which you experience, which presses upon you. And I think that this whole area of reverence it really needs to be taken on. I think we live in a world which is notable for its lack of reverence, true reverence. I think the materialistic, consumerist, throwaway cult of celebrity, media-driven, marketing-driven world is totally antithetical to the experience of reverence. And I think we really need to look into our hearts to see how much we're affected by it, by the lack of proper reverence, a real experience of reverence. I think our society is so against it. I think there's so much all-pervading cynicism and materialism and so on that is really against us, and it actually vitiates even our Dharma life. Even Dharma life, well, it's not a real Dharma life, it's a pseudo-Dharma life, gets turned into another consumerist-driven activity, you know, where you can have your Buddhism online, even it seems your spiritual experience online, safe, technique-driven. There's no real experience of some transcendental presence in your experience, mediated by actual living beings and symbols, where you have to sort of surrender and really open up to something greater. It's about convenience and something for you. This is something that Sangharakshita went into in a fantastic lecture, which I was present for in about 1974, 75, called Enlightenment as Experience and as Non-Experience. There's another one called The Path of Irregular and Regular Steps. And in those, he talks a lot, even this is back in the 70s, about the loss of reverence, even quoting people like Goethe and Coleridge, talking about the loss of reverence in their own eras. But I think it does really vitiate our whole attitude to life, and that affects our whole participation in Dharma life. There's a whole culture of Dharma life that can be missing, that we need to rediscover. And you can see it reflected in the life of the Buddha. You can see it reflected in the life of the Buddha even after his enlightenment. This is brought out in a sutta which is called the Gaurava Sutta, which thankfully Bhante has drawn to our attention. He started to do that many years ago, and more recently he brought it to light again. In the Gaurava Sutta, the Buddha has attained Bodhi. He's woken up to the truth, he's enlightened, he's a Buddha. And there's various experiences that kind of unfold from that. It seems that the enlightenment isn't just one thing. There's an unfolding sequence of, as it were, experiences, reflections that go on. And one of these he's reflecting, it is dukkha. It is painful. It is suffering. If a man has no other man to revere, to honour, to rely on, who can I revere and honour and rely on? Where is there such a Brahman or Samana? Where is there such a man that I can revere, look up to, honour, serve, depend on? The language that the Buddha is using is the language of discipleship. It's quite obvious. And there you see the spiritual culture, the human culture that the Buddha is coming from. He wants a teacher. He wants to serve. He wants to revere. It's as if what the Buddha is saying, that is a natural human need. Again, it's something I think it's been terribly sort of distorted and lost sight of in the modern world. There's such a reluctance to look up. You know, it's as if, you know, we do feel that we are the highest. Of course, we won't admit that. But actually, we don't really want to really look up to another. We don't really want to do that. We want to keep ourselves apart and separate. But what the fact that an enlightened being says it is painful not to revere is indicating something. It's saying that is a basic, fundamental human need, to find a man, you know, or someone worthy of reverence, worthy of service, worthy of honouring, worthy to learn from. This is a totally natural human need. And if it's stifled or disappointed, and so on, and many people, of course, have felt disappointed because perhaps they have done that and trusted and it has been broken, it's extremely painful. Well, it seems even a Buddha can recognise that unsatisfactoriness of not finding another to revere. And he can't find anybody. He's got the Buddha eye, he's got the divine eye, so he can survey the cosmos. And there's nobody. There's nobody, in all honesty, who he can see, who can revere and rely on and serve. We might do that. Well, if you do that and you don't find anybody, well, you're either a Buddha or you're very foolish. But anyway, the Buddha really... it's just a very, very bleak universe that you're in. But the Buddha can't find anybody. But he still wants to revere. So he reflects, but I will revere and rely on and serve the Dhamma. The Dhamma, the truth, reality. And this has been something that Sangharakshita himself has pondered very, very deeply. What on earth could this mean? What on earth could this mean? Because the Buddha is enlightened. In a sense, he is at the summit of things, but he suggests perhaps it's indicating that, well, as far as we're concerned, the Buddha is at the summit of things. There's nobody, we're not going to find anybody greater than the Buddha, but even for him, there is more that is going to open up. Mysterious, deeply mysterious levels, if you like, to call them that, or dimensions. And you certainly see the way the Buddha teaches, the way the Buddha communicates, the way the Buddha talks, the way he talks about the Dhamma, is as if it's something even greater than him. It's not definitely not his personal possession, his personal attainment. It's something very definitely he's serving, and serving for the benefit of others, bringing it to others so that they too may be liberated. It's definitely not his personal possession or anything like that. But he wants to revere. So reverence, Gaurava, so supremely important. And I think it gives us a bit of a key to how we might approach how we place the three jewels at the centre of our personal mandala, or what it really means to do that. I want to end this talk by going through the six Gauravas, the six reverences, or the six objects of reverence, and see how they might apply to us, just to get us into, you know, the feeling of reverence, the feeling of having something incredibly precious at the centre of our lives that we honour and worship and serve and live from, and which will then transform our lives. If we don't revere and honour what is most precious, there will be no transformation. It won't be important for us. It will just be an idea. And ideas, you know, are definitely not enough for living the Dharma life. We have to have our most cherished emotions involved. So the six reverences, or the six objects of reverence, are first of all the Sattha. S-A-T-T-H-A. The Sattha. Sattva means teacher, as in Sattva Deva Manusa, the teacher of gods and men. And the word Sattva is only used for the Buddha. So the Buddha is our first object, that's not the right word, but the first focus of reverence. But it's interesting that the Buddha is called here the Sattva, the teacher. It means... in this context, when they say that it implies that the Buddha is the teacher. He's the teacher above all other teachers, the teacher of gods and men. He is giving the truth. He embodies the highest possible ideal, and we revere him for that. and therefore his teaching is the truth, is the way things are. And we take, when we go for refuge to the Buddha, it's made very, very clear that we are not going for refuge to other things, you know, gods and other teachers and so on and so forth. That's made very, very clear in the tradition. You've decided that the Buddha is your central focus, that really he is the object of devotion for you. This is very important. Sometimes people get a little bit alarmed by this way of talking. They worry about fundamentalism and dogmatism, and some universalists feel very concerned, well, isn't the truth, you know, shared by other traditions? But the thing is, this is important for actual practical reasons. You know, if you really want to focus on a Dharma life, you have to decide. You have to choose what your path is. You know, you can't be riding several different horses at once. That's impossible. You're going to get into conflict. You've got to get right into a particular path. So going for refuge to the Buddha means that you've definitely decided that the Buddha is your refuge and that you're going to revere him. What it means is as well, it's not so much, it's not about being dogmatic or fundamentalist. It's more that you're going to give all your energy to really pondering the nature of the Buddha, the nature of enlightenment. I mean, one of the things that Sangha Rakshita has said over the years, that people who think that they know the Buddha really don't know him. And it's in a way when you really know that you don't know the Buddha, and when you know that you're very far away from the Buddha, strange to say, you're beginning to get a little bit nearer. When you really can be awe-inspired by the quality of the Buddha. I remember on a retreat once, a question and answer session, and it was when Buddha nature was really in fashion in the movement, you know, this, you know, hardcore Buddha nature, that you're enlightened already, you know, that you're a Buddha already, so, you know, it doesn't, you know, there's no path, you're already there, you need to wake up to it, all that sort of language, you know, mouth Zen, as it's sometimes called, or as Mr. Chen called it, Bhante's teacher. So somebody was asking Bhante about Buddha nature, and Bhante said, well, of course, the whole notion of Buddha nature, in the sense that we have the potentiality as human beings, we have the potentiality to become Buddhas. If you create the conditions, if you follow the path, you will emerge, you will flower as a fully enlightened being. Yes, of course. And of course that, I think sometimes people don't realise how profound that particular vision really is. You know, the awakening of Shraddha, the awakening of faith in that is extraordinarily profound. But when you wake up to potentiality, but he said the idea that somehow already you are fully enlightened with all the powers, all the qualities of a Buddha, he said, no, I don't think it's like that at all. And when he was talking, I realized how much devotion Sangha Rakshita had for the Buddha, how much he really revered the Buddha, and to arrogate to himself Buddhahood was impossible. Because he really was, in a sense, able to see the Buddha, in the sense of realizing how great, how vast the Buddha was, and how far away he was from the Buddha. Well, if that's true of Sangha Rakshita, it's certainly true of us. So what it means to revere the Buddha is to spend our lives pondering, if you like, the nature of Buddhahood, pondering the nature of enlightenment, studying the life of the Buddha, really feeling the stories in the life of the Buddha, and letting that really touch you, really affect you, really transform you. Then there's the Dhamma. This is the second of the Garavas. So the first is revering the Sutta, the Buddha, and then there's revering the Dhamma. First of all, this means, like the first Garava, that you really, if you go for refuge to the Dhamma, you take the Dhamma seriously. You follow the path of the Dhamma. You're not going to other paths or ways. It's the Dhamma. But again, to revere the Dhamma, again, means to realise what you have. Again, I think this word reverence is so important, because in the West, People are very, very quick with understanding. Doesn't matter how much education you've had. The predominant thing is that in a pretty, by and large, literate culture, as soon as people hear an idea, they think not only have they understood it, they've sort of mastered it. They know it. Doesn't matter whether they're embodying it or it's their being, they think they know. And there's part of that which is to do with possession. We use the language of mastering a subject. And when you master a subject, you feel superior to it. You feel, I've got that down. I know all that. And you sometimes see this with Buddhists. You know, they think that because they've understood intellectually the five precepts, or in the case of order members, the 10 precepts, they've understood the words and the different explanations. Oh, I don't need all that now. Or they've done a bit of mindfulness of breathing, metta bhavana, you know, and they know what it means. Oh, I don't need that now. What I need is the special teaching. But sometimes, you know, I have to pinch myself and say, when I hear this, and you do hear it, I have to ask myself, like some of the Zen masters did, can they hear what they're saying? Are they really saying what they're saying? When you study the 10 pillars of Buddhism, for example, you begin to realise how extraordinary even the first precept is. When you read Sangharakshita's explanation of the first precept, you can only bow your head in reverence. It's so profound. The undertaking to abstain from harming living beings and acting with loving kindness. It's so deep. And the ramifications are so far-reaching. My goodness, you can only... And you see yourself, how far you are away from it and how much there is, so you can only salute and revere. So yes, we need to revere the Dharma. And this is where Dharma study, real Dharma study. And when I say Dharma study, I don't mean just talking about the Dharma. I don't mean just thinking about the Dharma, and certainly not just reading about the Dharma, but reverently contemplating the Dharma. Real Dharma study is more like reverential contemplation. You're contemplating the words of the Dharma with reverence, really trying to feel their meaning. This is how it becomes an insight practice, a wisdom practice. This reverential contemplation of the truth, of the way of things, even the most apparently elementary things. And you can see after a while why in one place the Buddha talks about the Dhamma being like the great and mighty ocean. It's that vast, with so many qualities, so many wonders that open up within it. So that's revering the Dhamma. Revering the Dharma, the second Gaurava. And then there's revering the Sangha, of course. Revering the Sangha. And in particular, what's meant here is the Sangha of the Bodhisattvas, the Arahants, you know, the Aryas, those on the path, the great Buddhists, if you like, really learning to revere them so that they live, you know, in your consciousness. They live in your life. The great disciples of the Buddha. The great teachers like Milarepa, Padmasambhava, Shantideva, Shinran, Hukwin, you know, the great teachers on our refuge tree. They're tremendous objects of reverence. They embody lives lived, you know, really following the Dharma on a very, very high level. And that comes down to Sangharakshita and his own teachers. You know, these are, When you study these lives, when you really take them in, they can become real objects of reverence and inspiration. One of the things that I keep finding as I go on is how, well, particularly in relation to my teacher, and I'm not making any claims here for Sangharakshita. He doesn't make any claims about himself, about his own status at all, which is very interesting. And he's never said that he's a stream entrant or a bodhisattva or anything like that. But I have no idea of his status. But as I have never met a man greater. I have never met a man greater in my life. That's why I revere him and follow him. And one of the things that I'm discovering, I keep finding myself rereading little passages in his memoirs. and discovering how much of what he's taught us in the order come from his experience. And you have to, he's such a sort of subtle writer and very kind of low key in a way, but it's there. You can see this life lived, this example. And I end up revering him as, well, yes, as this higher Sangha refuge. Then there's the fourth Garava, the fourth object of reverence, which in Pali is the Sikha, S-I-K-K-H-A, Sikha. Or is it 1K, David? 2Ks, thank you. David's, he knows all about Indian languages, so it's the Sikha, Shiksha, in Sanskrit, for the Sanskritists among you. So we revere the training. This is how we can translate Sikha or Shiksha. We revere our training. Well, that's an amazing thing, isn't it? We cherish and revere and look up to the very practices that we engage in. I find this absolutely fascinating, that we treat, in other words, our training with great care and respect. We really value it and cherish it. We don't treat it, our different trainings, with, you know, casually. It's almost like we salute it. Of course, and our training, this relates to that as well, where has our training come from? As well, we have to remember that. Our training, of course, comes from the Buddha and the Buddhist tradition, but more immediately, our training comes from Sangharakshita, taught through his disciples. We have a very, very effective system of spiritual training, not just in terms of ethics, meditation, wisdom, but a whole life, a whole culture. There's so many aspects of the training that Sangharakshita has pointed to us. And it is really an amazing training. And sometimes I think you have to realise, or you have to, what is it, Bhante, in the Ten Pillars, Sangharakshita says something like, it's very easy to take the precepts for granted. And he quotes an English poet. He's, you know, to paraphrase, he said, an English poet, you must love them before they will seem worthy of your love. I think this is a very, very beautiful phrase. You must love your trainings before they will seem worthy of your love. It's a bit like the Metta-bhavana. You know, you have somebody in the Metta-bhavana who, well, you don't love them, but in loving them, in trying to love them, in developing loving kindness to them, after a while, actually, you see, well, yes, of course, they're another human being. They are worthy of loving. They are worthy of my love. Well, it's the same with our training. We have to contemplate. We have to reflect. When we're bored in the mindfulness of breathing, you know, we have to learn to love it. When we're bored in the Metta-bhavana, when we don't think it's that important, we have to learn to see the value of it. And it's the same with all of our different trainings. Spiritual friendship, for example. We might think, oh, it's all this spiritual friendship, you know, meeting up with these people, you know, the boring order members going on about the same thing, or going on retreat at Padmalaya, and Padmavaraja just bangs on about the same old stuff, you know, every time. Well, you've got to learn to love what I say before it will seem worthy of your love. As you can see, this is an unscripted talk, so I don't quite know where I'm going. But you see what I mean? It's so easy to take what we've been given for granted, what we have for granted. It's the besetting sin, I think, probably of human beings, you know, that we forget the real value of what we're given. We actually have so much. It's not just our training, it's our life, our world. I mean, some parts of the world, the idea of going away for 5 days on a retreat, where you can spend, you know, the first few hours of the day in complete silence after a good breakfast in a beautiful garden, and that's just not available. That's just an impossibility. There isn't the wealth, there isn't the leisure, there isn't the, how can you put it, there isn't the tolerance even to allow that. We have immense freedoms, this precious human existence, and we have a training, and we have a community in which we can train. So revere your training, revere the shiksha. Then the fifth reverence, the fifth object of reverence, is appamada. Appamada, mindfulness is, or vigilance. It literally means non-heedlessness. It's the word that the Buddha uses as his last teaching when he says to his disciples, behold, all impermanent things, all conditioned things are impermanent. Appamadena sampadeta, with mindfulness or with vigilance, strive, make effort, as if you just have, you know, these are the law, this is the law and the prophets. Vigilance and striving. You know, when Bhante used to do, you get this in the ordination ceremony, after you are given the refuges and precepts by your preceptor, at the end it says, having well observed the three refuges, together with the Dharmachari ordination vows, with mindfulness strive on. This is chanted in Pali. And Bhante used to say this, if you want to be sure that you're going for refuge is going to be effective, even to the point of stream entry, you need to remember these two things, mindfulness and striving. Be aware, wake up, be aware of what you need to develop and make the effort to develop it. That's what you need. In a sense, that's all you need. So you need to revere that quality of wakefulness and effort. And because of this, Sangharakshita says, he thinks that really revering appramada, revealing mindfulness, is really revering, if you like, all the spiritual qualities that you need to develop. Revering the spiritual qualities you're striving for. It's sometimes said, for example, before the metta bhavana, you don't just go straight into metta, reflect for a little while on the qualities of metta. Imagine the state of boundless loving kindness. Imagine that. Maybe you even imagine the Buddha. You imagine the Buddha's boundless loving kindness. Revere that in your consciousness. That's what you should visualize, if you like, metta. Visualize that state and then reverently contemplate it, and then go into the stages of the practice. Let that reverence support your practice and keep going back to that revering. Similarly with mindfulness of breathing. Don't just go straight into the breath. Don't just do a body scan or whatever it might be to get yourself into it. Imagine, revere, visualize, contemplate the state of clear, radiant, unbounded mindfulness, the Buddha's mindfulness. Imagine the Buddha's constant sort of presence all the time, this undimmed full consciousness, this full natural vigilance, and then go into developing the quality. So we need to revere, if you like, all the qualities of the path and contemplate them if we want to develop them. I think this is a really fascinating, you know, area of practice, and perhaps underestimated. Although not really, because in the order, when you're ordained, you're initiated into a meditation on a Buddha or Bodhisattva. And what you're really doing then, in that practice, is contemplating, well, all the qualities of Buddhahood. You're imagining them, they're vivid before you, inspiring you to develop them in all the areas of your life. So revering appamada, mindfulness, revering the qualities of the path. But then there's a sixth reverencing, and this is, I'm going to have to give the Pali, patisantara. So it literally means a spreading before, and by implication it can mean friendly welcome, honouring. So Sangharakshita tries to understand this. It's a rather obscure term, but the idea is it's what you do for a guest. When you welcome somebody, when you're friendly to somebody, you give them a good spread. You spread something out. You give them drink. You give them food. You welcome them in. So you're revering this. Revering this spreading before. You're revering sense, perhaps you're revering friendship and so on. So how does that relate to our Dharma life? How does that relate to transforming the mandala of our lives? I think the clue is really in Shantideva. Shantideva, who's the composer of the Bodhicharavatara, under the force of the inspiration of the arising of the bodhicitta, takes these wonderful bodhisattva vows for the benefit of all beings. And in one place he says, I spread out this happiness banquet for all beings. May everybody come and be refreshed by this happiness banquet. So I think what is perhaps being got at here is revering the altruistic aspect of Dharma life. That we revere the spreading of the Dharma before all beings. We're revering generosity, being generous with the Dharma. There is no Dharma life without spreading the Dharma out towards others. We might not be able yet to teach the Dharma formally, we might not be in that position, but we can do whatever we can in all of our dealings to communicate the Dharma. It might be in our warmth and friendliness to whoever we meet. It might be helping, it will be helping those who are really working hard to spread the Dharma in whatever way, working together to bring the vast riches of the Dharma to others. So these are the six reverences: revering the Sutta, the Buddha, revering the Dharma, revering the Sangha, revering our training, the Shiksha, the Sikha, revering Apramada, mindfulness, the qualities we're trying to develop, revering the spreading before, revering the life, the lived life of bringing the Dharma into the world for the benefit of all, so that all will be fed, all will be refreshed, all will drink from the well of the Dharma. Well, I think if we revere like this, the transformation of the mandala of our life will actually happen. If we really revered in this way these different aspects of the three jewels in our life, there would be a radical change, not just in our own life, but for the benefit of others. And on that note, I'll finish.